There's been a movement from manufacturing, where unions tended to dominate, to areas of services.
This is Civios, your source for public affairs research. A podcast from the Humphrey School of Public Affairs at the University of Minnesota.
In this episode, we are talking with Professor Morris Kleiner of the Humphrey School of Public Affairs. Professor Kleiner's research includes the analysis of institutions in the labor market, the influence of labor management policies on organizations, and the role of labor unions in democratic societies. He has served as an expert on labor issues to government, labor, nonprofits, and business. And we are delighted to have this opportunity to learn more about your work, Professor Kleiner. Welcome.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here and glad to talk about my work.
Great. You know, it's always helpful for our listeners to have some background context of this research, and that starts with hearing more about your own background. And basically, what was your motivation for exploring this area of study?
In my case, just by chance, I was working in Washington, D.C. at the Brookings Institution, and I was assigned to work in the Department of Labor, and my boss, who was an assistant to the Secretary of Labor, got an assignment to look at issues of occupational regulation. And being the relatively new person on the team, I was given that assignment. And having thought I had drawn the short straw, I was very upset. And then I started to look into the issue and worked with my colleagues at the Department of Labor, Federal Trade Commission, and found out it was a fascinating area.
Many people think of occupational licensing as a minor issue in our country. Can you talk about why this isn't necessarily true and isn't the case?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I really thought this was a minor issue, that it would involve going through a bunch of statutes and looking at people who are already licensed. But as it turns out, and especially most recently, occupational licensing affects a lot more workers than are influenced by labor unions or the minimum wage. In fact, recent analysis and surveys suggest at least 25% of the U.S. workforce must have permission from government in order to work, and that's the definition of having an occupational license. If you don't have permission from government, you can't do your job.
So let's talk more about the different levels of government, the different layers of government. And can you talk a little bit about why is state legislation passed and signed on occupational regulation?
Well, largely, it's almost a perfect storm. That is, you have people who want to become regulated. They do common tasks. They work in an area that is generally viewed as being very similar. They get together. They tax their members. They go to legislators and say they'll help them on their campaigns, both for door knocking and financially, so that there's someone in the legislature who will often, as they say, carry the water for a new piece of legislation to license an occupation. The governor also has an incentive to license occupations because the fees that come in from individuals who are licensed are much greater than the cost of monitoring. So individuals who are in the occupation have incentives to become licensed. Legislators have incentives as well to promote licensing, as does the governor. So there's alignment in terms of incentives to promote more occupations to become regulated.
So that is just a high-level overview of how state governments are involved. Can you talk a little bit more about, on the federal level, there's been focus as well on occupational licensing. Specifically, can you talk about why the Brookings Institution and the Obama White House and the Trump administration are also interested in the topic of occupational licensing?
Well, this is an issue that is nonpartisan as opposed to bipartisan. That is, you have from the left, individuals are concerned about access to jobs, the ability to become regulated, or an opportunity to become regulated. Also, you have from the right issues of economic liberty, that is, the government is imposing its will on the ability of individuals to make a living. So this has really become an issue for both the right and the left. And given the growth of occupational licensing from about 5% in the 1950s, you think of doctors and lawyers, and now you have a wide variety of occupations in the service industry that you have to get permission from government in order to work. So the Brookings Institution was interested in this. The Obama administration was interested in this as in terms of the ability of low-income individuals to be able to make a living. And the Trump administration tends to be interested in this in terms of regulating the labor market and regulating the economy.
Is there anything else that you can say about this federal focus on occupational licensing that is important for the typical consumer to know about?
Well, I think there are many issues. For example, in the Affordable Care Act, only individuals in licensed occupations are allowed to get compensation under the Affordable Care Act. Also, individuals often have to pay more money for licensed services and have less access, especially if occupations are able to limit the number of people who are in an occupation. And you also have issues of battles between the occupations, doctors and practical nurses, nurse practitioners, often battle over who can do the work. And all this ends up being an issue of access, prices, and quality of service.
So who really benefits and who loses when occupations become licensed?
Well, certainly the individuals who become licensed generally benefit. They get higher wages, higher benefits. It's easier for them to find jobs. They have higher pensions. So they are certainly the ones who benefit. Others might say that this is a path to a career, but also the counter to that is there are significant barriers, high fixed costs to entering these occupations. And as a result, people in the occupations benefit, but it often comes at the cost of higher prices and less access for consumers.
Can you talk a little bit more for our listeners about the occupations where this would be a path to employment?
Well, certainly occupations such as nursing, other occupations that more recently interior designers have been licensed in a number of states. So this is a way for people in these occupations to have a clear career path, which will for them guarantee higher wages, greater employment stability, and greater benefits if they're able to get access to the capital and have the time to get over these licensing hurdles.
If this varies from state to state, can you talk about the ramifications of that on the occupation?
Yeah, well, certainly in the U.S., unlike many other countries, occupational licensing has evolved to be a state process. And this is as a result of a number of Supreme Court decisions that occupational licensing and regulations have devolved to the state level, and in some cases to the local level. So this is a legal issue, and it has implications for, again, who can enter these occupations. And there's a great deal of variance. For example, to become a beautician or a cosmetologist, some states require 1,000 hours. Other states require over 2,000 hours to become a licensed cosmetologist.
So when we broaden the scope even more to an international level. What is the international interest in the topic of occupational licensing? For instance, in the European Union or even China?
Well, this has been an area that's been growing worldwide, and for largely the same kind of reasons that occupational regulation has been occurring in the U.S. That is, there's been a movement from manufacturing, where unions tended to dominate, to areas of services where occupations tend to dominate, and they want to have a web of rules or control over who's in the occupation and controlling also the labor market for who's potentially someone who can provide these services. And this is true worldwide. So in the European Union, there's tremendous interest in who can move across state boundaries. So can you move from Poland to the UK and be a licensed plumber or a licensed electrician? And the European Union has tried to create a European Union market, but there are individuals in each of the countries who want to be able to control who can be a licensed plumber or an electrician. And this has become a major issue for the European Union, and I've been asked to provide advice to the European Commission in Brussels and have given several talks to them about this important issue for labor markets in the European Union. In China, that's also an issue because licensing largely is in its infancy. So there's a lot more certification of occupations where the occupation says someone has passed a certain level of education and training, but others can provide the services to licensing, where only individuals who have a certain level of government approval can take money for providing those services.
When you have been invited to give a presentation, let's say when you've gone to Brussels, and you've given your presentation, what are the typical questions that you're asked afterwards? What do they want to know more about?
Well, very similar to the questions that are asked in legislatures around the U.S. and when I've testified at the U.S. Senate. That is, what are the benefits and costs? That it's not a one-size-fits-all. Who gains? Who loses? What are the labor market implications? That is, issues of access to work. What happens to wages and employment and job security, but also what happens to consumers? Are consumers better protected as a result of occupational regulation?
And do you have an educated opinion on that?
Well, I think based on the research that largely has taken place at the Humphrey School with a number of my colleagues and as well as at other universities around the U.S. and around the world, that occupational regulation does well for individuals in the occupations. As I've mentioned, they get higher wages, benefits, can find jobs more quickly. And also, there are problems in the sense that employment is less in those licensed occupations. Access by consumers is less. And there really hasn't been much evidence that licensing does dramatically better than certification or markets in general in terms of protecting the public.
So let's dig a little bit deeper into and return to your own research. And I know that Professor Janet Johnson at the Humphrey School and you are doing research on the influence of occupational licensing on interstate migration. What have you found?
Well, this just is a very quick background. This was an issue that Michelle Obama became very interested in. There was an individual who was being moved from Fort Bragg, North Carolina, to Fort Ord in California. And their trailing spouse was a teacher, and they would have to go back to school for a couple of years to become a licensed teacher. And they said, as a result of this, they would have to get government assistance. Well, Michelle Obama and later Jill Biden became very upset that individuals who were moving across state lines could not just pick up and become a teacher again, that they had to go back to school for a long period of time. And this is an example, but it really illustrates the issue that in many of these occupations, the ability to work in a state in a licensed occupation varies state by state. And this reduces the ability of individuals to go across state lines and to, at least in a national sense, be able to maximize their ability to make a living where they think it is best for them. And our work has really found that this is a significant impediment for what economists call labor market churning. That is the ability of people to go to where they think they can best do for themselves, their ability to make a living in a state that offers the best opportunities. But when there are these licensing barriers, as in the case that Michelle Obama initially found out about, that this significantly reduces interstate migration, it reduces labor market efficiency, and it reduces the ability of individuals who want to be able to go to where they have the best opportunities.
So what are the policy implications of this research? What do policymakers need to keep in mind?
Well, I think that the policymakers, and starting again with my initial report at the Brookings Institution, which later evolved into a White House report, and now there's a number of individuals in the Trump administration who are taking up this issue, again, all for very different reasons, is that it's important to make the labor market both more equitable in terms of individuals from low-income occupations being able to enter areas, for example, in the beauty industry, hairdressers, manicurists, and many other occupations where now it takes about a year and $15,000, $20,000 for them to enter these occupations. And it's important for state legislators and individuals at the national level to say what is appropriate for individuals to enter an occupation. Are these barriers too high? If they're too high, or do you need licensing at all for many of these occupations? So these are all issues that individuals around the country and state legislatures at the national level in Congress, and there have been some proposals to reduce regulations or to provide moral suasion for the states to reduce these regulations. And there have been a number of successes in terms of governors vetoing new licensing legislation or setting up commissions to see if the benefits of regulation are greater than the costs.
So even in emerging and in new areas, new markets, let's turn our focus to another example of your current research. Your work on the occupational licensing of Uber drivers has gotten a lot of attention. And what has your research found specifically for drivers and prices and the quality of service for Uber users?
Yeah, this is work with a doctoral student here at the Humphrey School, Jason Hicks, who's very much involved in the work and has done tremendous amount of work and effort into this issue. This is work that we are not compensated for, but Uber has provided us the data, which is a tremendous asset in terms of being able to look at this particular issue. And what we have found is where the regulations, and these are largely city regulations, they're not state regulations. For example, in New York, in order to be an Uber driver, you have to meet the same requirements as being a taxi driver. So you have to spend several months going to classes, spending well over $1,000 to $2,000 to take these classes and pass a wide variety of exams. And only licensed drivers can pick someone up in New York. And we have looked to see if there's more drivers in New York. And in fact, there are fewer drivers per capita, Uber drivers in New York relative to most other major areas where the regulations are dramatically less. So the supply of drivers is lower. The prices in New York are, to take an Uber, are very close to the prices of taking a cab. And our investigation looking at people who are picked up by licensed drivers in New York versus New Jersey, or when Houston deregulated. Houston didn't do it, but in fact the state of Texas said that no states could license Uber ride-sharing drivers in the state of Texas. Uber, in fact, had pulled out of Austin with some negative consequences in terms of accidents in Austin. But we have not been able to find that there's much difference in the quality of the rides or hard braking or hard accelerations in the licensed or unlicensed cases. So there tends to be a lot of negative consequences, fewer drivers with tougher regulation, higher prices, and not much difference in terms of what the consumer sees. So this has been an interesting area. It's gotten a lot of attention, and I assume it will be getting even more attention as our research proceeds to cover additional cities.
When people start to think about this area, it feels that there's a lot of layers and it's very complex, but can you talk a little bit more about why it's important for the typical consumer of services to understand the ramifications of occupational licensing? I think we tend to, somebody else is going to deal with that, but why is it important that we understand the ramifications?
Well, it's very important for a number of reasons. First, you need to go back to what are the incentives for all the parties involved. And the incentives for people in the occupation are to get higher wages, have greater employment opportunities. And certainly the way they do that is to get the government to create a monopoly. That's what a license is that only those people who have a government monopoly are allowed to provide the service. If anyone else provides that service, they are heavily fined or go to jail. So you, as a consumer, you can only go to the monopoly to get those services. And from sort of basic economics, if you're the only provider of that service, you can charge a higher price. Quality doesn't have to be that much better because consumers have no other choices other than to go to the monopoly, that is the licensed practitioners of those services. So the individuals who are in the occupation have tremendous incentives to lobby the government, lobby the legislature, lobby the governor as a result of their getting significantly higher wages and having more employment opportunities. But consumers are paying maybe a few dollars more if they get a haircut every few weeks, or they get their nails done every once in a while. So if they're paying a couple bucks more, the incentives are not there for consumers to lobby the legislature or the governor or the National Congress to say, these monopolies exist. I'm not getting any better services. I'm paying more for them. But there's such a small part of consumption expenditures that it's not worth your effort.
Well, this has been really important to have this conversation, and I really appreciate this opportunity to talk with you about your work. But I'm not going to let you go and end this interview before I ask you on a more personal note. You had indicated to me earlier that you're a Minnesota Twins fan. Who are your favorite fans to take to the Minnesota Twins game?
Well, that's the easiest question you've asked during the interview. I have 8 grandchildren, and they're all huge Minnesota Twins fans. And I take them and their friends, and we fill out a whole section of Target Field. And I enjoy it greatly, and they end up with lots of Twins memorabilia and plenty of hot dogs. So that is one of my favorite things to do.
Thank you for listening to another podcast from Civios, an initiative of the Humphrey School of Public Affairs at the University of Minnesota. To learn more about this segment, please visit civios.umn.edu.